Blog Talk Radio.
It's the V-Spot. I'm your host, Dr. Vic Tater. My co-host is Bill Foster. V-Spot Radio is brought to you by Planet Vic Tater Blog Network. Get everything you need and a few things you truly do not want. Only at Planet Vic Tater.
Hello, I'm Dr. Vic Tater. This is my associate, Nilvin Foster.
Oh, yeah. Hey.
All right, I'm supposed to be talking to Shane Douglas soon. We've been on this down this path before, hopefully he shows. How are you doing, Nil?
Still a little bit of sore throat, but not as bad as, the vertigo headaches.
Okay, well, this would be a good time, Zane, to tell you this. You know how ABC Family is always doing a bunch of new dramas?
They are?
Oh, yeah. They're usually teen dramas about where sex is bad for teenagers or something. Anyway, they got this new show about a family that adopts a bunch of children from broken homes and stuff. And you want to know what it's called?
What?
The Fosters.
Oh, God.
I tell you, Cousin Bananas is coming any day now. All right, and I guess while we're waiting, we can play a play a promo for one of our sponsors.
Look out, evildoers! There's a new crime fighter in town. Here comes the Blue Roofie.
Unpanto, criminal scum! Prepare to be brought to justice! But first,
can I buy you a drink?
Okay! You know, I think that's gonna be a dynamite. I think that's gonna be a real sleeper hit.
What about That's Not My Giraffe?
Well, again, that could. You know, I like this show, but I think it's going to be a bit of a reach. Bit of a stretch.
A tall order, if you will.
Yeah, that. Also, it's a giraffe with a very long neck.
You just heard it, didn't you?
Okay, we're still waiting for the guest to come in. Hopefully he shows. So, anything, Dan, the pikes you're looking forward to, Neil?
How do you figure?
I don't know, like any movie, comic.
I need to hear whether or not that game Pandora's Tower got pushed back when it's supposed to be the end of the month.
Okay, well, you know, the big thing is there's going to be a new Dragon Ball Z movie at the end of March. And we heard spoilers today, and I mean, I'm just giddy about it because they've done other new animation for Dragon Ball since GT ended. But those felt like these little between-the-cracks things. Well, this feels like a full-blown return. Now, there's rumors that it's actually going to get an American release. Or at least release in the countries besides Japan. Like, they're preparing it for IMAX theaters.
I always wonder how you actually make an animated movie for IMAX. Especially digitally now.
That's a good question. I mean, I'm not quite sure what IMAX is. Isn't that some 3D shit?
It can be, but it's a very large-scale type of projection.
Yeah, it's like, I don't get it. I mean, I don't really get Blu-ray or HD TV or things like that. I mean, to me, it just seems like just TV. I don't see why it has to be so fancy or clear. Though, mind you, I think the worst argument I ever heard against HD was somebody was talking at the office. They said, Jenna Fisher isn't that pretty on HD TV. And I'm thinking, that's a great slogan. Pretty girls aren't as pretty. Come buy our $5,000 television. Yeah, I just don't really get the selling point for that. In the coming weeks, we're going to be doing a Ninja Gaiden show and probably a Castlevania show. So we can't go quite as in-depth on Castlevania because, frankly, those games are hard as shit. I can't guarantee I can't beat as many as I would want to.
Have you tried Symphony of the Night on the PSP?
Not yet, because PSP had a run-in with my four-year-old nephew, and now the disc tray, I'm scared to open it again because I'm afraid it won't close back. Mind you, the games might still play on it. I'm not sure.
I figured it should. I mean, isn't the game still on it? Is it still reading it? You don't have to open it.
No, Connor took it out.
Do you know where it is?
Yeah, I've got the game right by me. It's in the case. I just don't know what the deal is, with it is. I am going to kill that monkey.
Makes you laugh, make you think.
Oh, wait. Hello.
How are you? It's the franchise calling in.
Oh, okay, great. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time. Neil, you're free to go now.
Okay.
All right, we have Shane Douglas online, the promoter, and are you the owner of Extreme Rising?
I'm the jack of all trades. I'm the guy that, I guess, the trash can receptacle. I'm the guy that cleans up at the end of the night. I'm the guy that wears just about every hat in the company.
All right, Shane, I bet you at the Crossfire show in August. I remember you being really cool to everybody because you had a bunch of people waiting for you after the show, and I remember I was really impressed with how you shook everybody's hand and looked everyone in the eye.
Well, you know, I've always been, impressed by the fans. You know, I think wrestling fans are the greatest fans in the world. You know, I've spent my career in this business for a reason. The wrestling fans have given me, you know, a life I could have never dreamt of. And a career that I could have only have ever dreamt of. And so I feel the least I can do is to say hello and talk. I'm interested in talking to the fans. I love hearing what they have to say. To me, you know, Dixie Carter spends millions of dollars trying to figure out what the fans want. Go out the front door and talk to them. They'll tell you what they want. You know, it's a lot more genuine, I think, to look the fan in the eye, shake their hands, talk to them, and give them that time that they put into you. I mean, I've had people watch me for 32 years, and I would have never dreamt that I was breaking into wrestling that anybody would ever even give a damn what I was doing, let alone to have been given the blessed career that I've been given. So, you know, for me, I mean, it's the absolute least I can do is to sit down and listen to the fans that put me on that play in that spot and have given the opportunity. And like I said, as somebody who runs a company and trying to bring wrestling back to the business, why go pay some marketing guy someplace to find out what wrestling fans want? I see wrestling fans every night I'm at work. I'll look them in the eye and ask them myself. I'm a people person, and I'd much rather be talking to fans than sitting and listening to the same joke for the 5,000th time in the dressing room from somebody or whatever. Not that I don't enjoy talking to the guys, but I also enjoy talking to the fans because now I wear a different hat. You know, as a writer and a booker, I want to hear what the fans want to see. So, you know, all these interviews you've heard me do over the last couple of years about Extreme Rising and Crossfire and different places that I think have the opportunity to maybe put a different stamp on the business and bring some of the wrestling back to the business, most of what you hear me say is echoed off of something that a fan has told me someplace. So I just think that that's the fastest way to do it is to cut right through the BS and ask, you know, go straight to the source.
Yeah. You know, that night I really appreciate because you signed my ECW belt for me, and you look, and I remember just thinking how hard you looked for a silver pin to sign it for me.
Well, on those belts, it gets, you know, especially when you get a few names on it, it becomes so difficult to find a place because, you know, I used to think to myself, you know, the smartest guy or the luckiest guy, whichever way it turned out, in the business was Taz. Three letters and you're done, you know. Mine is the franchise, Shane. But it's like writing a book, you know. So I need a little bit of space, and I wanted to show up whenever I saw it.
Let me ask you, going back to the beginning of your career, you worked some WWF tapings as an enhancement talent. How was that working with Randy Savage and Paul Orndorff?
It was great. You know, I mean, at that point in my career, well, first of all, at that stage of my career, I didn't even have in mind that I'd have a career. I just was in love with wrestling, and at that stage of my life, I had the time to do it and was interested in doing it. To be honest with you, my thought at that point, as far as my career would go, would be that I'd finish college, and after college, I'd go to D.C., and God knows what political scandal I would have been caught up in if I had followed that path. It'd probably be the next Watergate. But when I went up there and the first night Mick Foley and I went up there, Dominic was in a van full of us up, of all a bunch of the students. Mick Foley and I were the two that were always picked to wrestle on every, back then they would do three and sometimes four tapings. And Mick and I would both wrestle three or four times, depending on how many tapes. However many tapes they did that night, we would work. And the first night we went, I wrestled. Randy Savage was the first person I wrestled going up there, and then and that was just right at the beginning of his peak to the top. And then Paul Orndorff after that, but with Bobby Heenan managing him, and they were just very gracious guys, both of them. You know, and I think I learned a lot from that later in my career, that when I did work with underneath guys and enhancement guys, I remember Mick Foley coming back after working with the British Bulldogs, and Dynamite Kid threw him in for a clothesline and hit him right in the jaw on purpose. And thinking to myself the difference, you know, there I was working with two real gentlemen. I mean, they were, you know, Randy and Paul were both fantastic guys to work with, extremely appreciative that I would bump for them and, you know, get their stuff over. And I'll never forget, I think like one of the highlights even now of my career was Bobby Heenan coming back and telling me that I took the pile driver from Paul Orndorff better than anybody had taken it. And I'm just being so thrilled by that. And, through the years that the business went on, enhancement guys became, almost overlooked. Like, they didn't matter. Like, you could do whatever you want to them, treat them however you want, like they're pieces of garbage. And I just never saw it that way. I mean, to me, if a guy's going to go out there and work his tail off to try to make me look like a star, or make me look better, or make me look professional, then it's the least I can do is to take care of him, not break his jaw, for instance, and to thank him afterwards and be appreciative. And I think I learned that way back in those first tapings with Paul and Randy.
You know, I watch some of those old TBS shows now, and I'll see a guy wrestling Kevin Sullivan or Ron Garvin, and I'm thinking, I don't know how much he made for that night, but it wasn't nearly enough.
Yeah, you know, those guys, some of those guys, especially in the old school, the old timers were smart. I think a lot of it has to come back to our business. If you go back and talk to those enhancement guys that worked with them, I'm sure they won't complain about the way the business was and how snug it was. If anything, I think they probably complain about the business today and how unsnug it's become. And, I feel like I'm like a beating a dead horse because I've talked about this for so long. Our business has ceded away to the UWF, to the UFC and the MMA and the shoot fight companies, the best parts of our business. You go back and you watch some of those early matches, you know, with the Terry Funks and the Kevin Sullivans and, you know, those guys that would really get in and rough knock everybody around. And then you see what's going on in the business today. It's not that the kids are any less. I think the kids are much, much better athletes today than have ever been in the business. The business is being so overly micromanaged that the kids are afraid. I say the kids, not condescendingly, I just mean chronologically, that the kids are afraid to go out and fart unless they're told how to do it because they might not do it right. And I, in the business day, I know, thank God, I had the opportunity to become the franchise when I did and the creative liberties that I had with that character because I couldn't go out there and memorize 27 lines of verbiage and 29 minutes of match, and I just couldn't do it. It would become very confining, and I don't think nearly as fun as the fun I had at the times that I executed that character. I just think the business is way overly produced today. Let these kids go. Now, the ones that can't do it will sink to the bottom. That's what competition is supposed to be about. But the ones that can do it will rise to the top, and you'll get a special character out of doing that by allowing those kids to compete against each other instead of just handing somebody a spot and saying, here, kid, go out and read this and pretend to do this and then be like this or be like that. Let them go out there and steer it themselves. Then they'll screw it up sometimes. But once they finally get the wheels on the track, there'll be something special, especially by today's standards. Where, you know, I see very, very, very little in the business that I can sink my teeth into.
All right. Let me fast forward a little bit to, because I was watching a lot of 98 ECW recently. Mm-hmm. And the feud that led up to you losing the belt to Taz, and watching the TV, I feel like, you know, just as a viewer, that you really should have won that match at Guilty as Charged. Even if you lost the belt the next week, it felt like that you should have won that match at Guilty as Charged just to put the belt over.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, I don't second guess anything that was done because, I mean, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking, looking back, I can say this in working with anybody I did, whether it was Taz or it was Raven, Tommy Dreamer, Terry Funk, Sabu, anybody I worked with in ECW gave me 150%, and I tried to do the same back. So, you know, it's you know, there were multiple times that I thought we should go a different direction, like the night that I beat Al Snow in Georgia. I felt strongly because my palate being fractured, my elbow being messed up, at that time, I wasn't sure, you know, what I was going to do, but I felt very strongly just for the belt's sake, to keep the belt over. Instead of keeping it on a half-crippled guy, let's put it on somebody, and Al could go at that time, let's put it on somebody that can carry it for a while and do whatever you have to. If you want to keep the belt on me, I can come back. You know, so we had differences like that. Paul and I had a lot of differences like that over the belt on when to keep it on me, when to take it off me. But by and large, I think the body of work that we created in ECW stands up very well to today, and I think well into the future, until somebody else comes along and decides to throw some crazy idea to the wind and see what the fans will catch on to. I happen to believe the stars are lined up right for it to happen now. The business, if you look at the parallels between the business of 1992 and early 93 that gave rise to ECW in the first place, we're right back there again, if not much, much worse off than we were at that time. The business had never been as high as it was after that period, in, say, the late 90s, early 2000s. The argument can be made that it's had a much more precipitous fall in this latest low wave, low tide, if you will. You know, Vince was drawing 8s and 9s in the ratings 10 years ago. Now he's having to hot shot to get into the 3s. TNA, forget about it. Same 105 rating they've always had for 10 times the money. You know, it's just really sad because there's so much incredible talent out there that if they had the right person or persons doing the booking, that were going from the standpoint of looking at it through old school eyes, Not saying hold an arm bar for 20 minutes. I can't stand when somebody says, old school, what do you mean, grab an arm bar for 20 minutes? No, I mean making a compelling match that doesn't belittle and embarrass the fans and treat them like an idiot, something that's realistic and looks like a competition, something that titillates your senses to want to see more, not something that sits there and makes you keep looking at your watch to see how much longer is on before you can turn it off. That's what I'm talking about when I say old school, and there are a ton of people out there that could bring that to the table. Like for instance, when I look at TNA and I see, you know, Bobby Roode and Samoa Joes and AJ Styles and Chris Daniels and Austin Aries, and you get on this list of incredible talent that they have down there, the Frankie Kazarians, and, you know, these kids that just really just need a direction to go in, that it seems implausible to me that a billion-dollar corporation would, after hiring and after 3 years, nearly 3 years, or probably 3 years plus at this point, keep those same people. And even though they haven't delivered and the expenditures have shot through the roof, if I came and ran your little lemonade stand and it was costing you 50 times the money to put the lemonade out the door, but you were selling less lemonade after hiring me, I doubt you'd keep me running your lemonade stand. Yet TNA has done exactly that with the management team they have in place right now. I guess only in wrestling could that happen, because I haven't spent 32 years in any other industry, but, well, I'd love to talk to the CFO of Panned Energy and find out what kind of charitable guy or woman that must be that's dishing that kind of money into that deep a hole.
Well, you know, I kind of got this feeling that between that and WWE not really wanting to seem to make new stars, that they must have some producers that scam going that I just can't get my brain around.
I didn't catch that last part. The producers of what?
You know that movie, The Producers?
Oh, yes.
Where, you know, you put on Broadway play, and it makes it somehow, when it fails, it makes you more money.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, isn't that a Mel Brooks, I think, a Mel Brooks production? And I don't know if I'd be willing to put my $1 billion into a Mel Brooks comedic idea. I don't know. I mean, I really can't explain it, because from the 32 years that I've spent in the business, this is not where I believe the business would be at this point after the highs that it's had. To see, you know, both companies hiring writers from outside the industry at a time when, like I said earlier in the interview, the fans will tell you what they want to see. In the last few years that I've been on the road, the last, say, 2.5-3 years, 100% of the fans that I've talked to, not any other smaller portion, every single fan I've spoken to, and I've spoken to thousands, have told me the same few comments, and they're basically broken down to, I've been a lifelong wrestling fan, I was the world's biggest mark, and I haven't watched wrestling in years. Now, those three statements are incongruous to me, because one of them doesn't belong. I'm a lifelong wrestling fan, I was the world's biggest mark, but I haven't watched in years. That doesn't make sense to me, except when you put into context what's been going on in the business for the last 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And when you look at those fans that are saying it, and you look at the Raids group, and you look back at what they grew up watching, and the next sentence out of their mouth would be, man, if somebody would put something back like that on the air, I'd be back to the table as a fan again. So it just seems implausible to me that nobody is picking up on that. That none of the big companies seem to, either don't give a damn about what their fans want, or B, they think they know more than what their fans know, or C, they're just out spitting in the wind someplace. And from no standpoint does that make none of those three sound like good business sense to me. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding, Victor. When you look at the ratings, you know, TNA has never had a year when they've had what anybody would call a rousing rating success. Their highest in the last 5 years was a 1.17 5 years ago. Their lowest was last year, a 1.05. Statistically insignificant. Same. That's basically an apple to an apple to an apple to an apple to an apple. 5 years are the same exact thing. The only difference in those 5 years is that Panda Energy's expenditures have exploded through the roof. I can't give you a percentage, but I would imagine that to be something in the neighborhood of a multiple of 10, 20, or 30 of what they used to spend to get the same rating. Now, if I said to you 5 years ago you could buy this car for $10,000, this year it's going to cost you $1.5 million, you'd think I was nuts.
Yeah, but you ain't going to go for it.
Yeah, no, you and I wouldn't, but Dixie Carter would. So if you want to make a few bucks, go try to sell her your car. You might get rich. I don't know. It just seems strange to me that that's where the business is. But all that negativity said, that's where I see the positive to the business, because the big two are getting it so wrong, just like they were in 1992. The big two then were, of course, WWF and WCW. Got it so wrong that the fans searched out for something new and they found ECW. The business is right in the same place again, and I believe those fans are digging and searching again and looking for something. What I think the fan base has to do is the fan base has to decide what it is they're looking for. And I think right now it's sort of like a little bit all over the place. You know, the younger fans want more of the high-flying stuff. The older fans want more of the mat stuff. They need to settle on something that, turn it on, it's like a plate of food. If it looks good, take a taste. If it doesn't taste good, spit it out. If it does taste
well,
devour the plate.
You know, a year ago, like in 2011, I went to a TNA taping in Huntsville. And the one thing, I said this as a fan, the one thing I don't care about anymore is talking segments. Now, I don't mind like a promo when you have a guy, like, you know, in the old days when you have a guy talk for 3 minutes, but you'll have people out there talking for 20 minutes. And
yeah.
I remember watching this, and not nobody in that arena was entertained by it. Like, they had this one segment went on for, you know, just people talking. And you could actually, I think you could actually see me on TV looking at my cell phone.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, the thing, again, you're not, you know, there's so many things, so many facets that are different. You know, it's a continental divide between old school and new school. And I'm not going to imply that all new school is bad. But in the old school, you learn very quickly what worked and what didn't, what sold and what didn't. And you never went back to the well again if it didn't sell. I remember early on as the franchise in the ECW arena, I was out there having a ton of fun, just having the ball of my life, and just, you know, going into my character and just really wound the crowd up. And after a few minutes, they started dying out. So I thought, well, I'll get them back. I'll just, you know, keep talking, and I'll hit on something that'll finally catch them. And I went about another 90 seconds or so, and instead of getting them back, they were just dying more and more. And finally, about 4 minutes in, I thought, I got to wrap this up because there's no, you're not getting them back. It's clear they're gone. You know, they've stopped listening to what I've got to say, and I wrapped it up. So after that, I would try to keep it as tight as I could. In other words, I learned from it. Those super long promos, look, especially today, it would have been virtually impossible to cut a long promo like that back in the day. I remember the one episode when Paul did the whole episode was me doing a promo, an interview, which it really wasn't. It was really three separate segments that we shot. But the reason we had to do it is we had no extra footage. We were out of footage for that week, and we had to put a tape on the air. So, you know, Paul, thank God, came up with the idea of the questions, and I was able to handle them and speak in depth enough about those questions that he asked that it filled it up. But, look, you cannot go to a live crowd and talk for, like you said, 20 minutes or any kind of length of time that you're not going to lose them. And it's real simple. In the old school, you have gone out and said, you know, your job was to pay attention to the crowd. If a promoter hired you and you weren't entertaining that crowd, for instance, if we planned on going out tonight and doing match A and it didn't work, well, 5-6 minutes into it, we better change the match B, because if we go back to that dressing room and an old promoter like Bill Watts was waiting for you and you didn't entertain those fans, the Cowboy would not be happy when you got back. And the Cowboy not being happy was not a fun time to come back to the dressing room. So you knew instinctively to change it up, audible on the fly. That's one of the things the kids can't do today. Why? Because they sit in the back and talk for 6 hours. I'll do this, then you do this, then I'll do that, and you do that. And it's just regurgitating an idea of a match they've had. Back in the old days, you know, in the days when I was coming into the business, you'd have to literally audible on the fly. If it wasn't working, you'd go to something else. And that's why I think some of those old school matches were so special, because you'd see them doing so many different things in the match. And you know, they might be going down this vein of saying a brawling type match. And then all of a sudden you see them go over here and suddenly, you know, mat wrestling broke out in the middle of it. And then someplace after that, somebody's doing a flying move or something. And that was usually what that was being caused by. And I think, you know, that's just a lack of ability in the fans. And again, you can't blame the kids, because this is what they've been told. Somebody in the back wrote that garbage for them to go out there and talk for that length of time. And so they did, because that's what they were told to do. Boy, I mean, I don't know who would call. Ric Flair at his best couldn't do a 20-minute promo that could compel an audience today. And especially today, because they have a much shorter attention span. I mean, you know, back in the day, you know, we used to read books 1,100 pages long. Today, if you can get somebody to watch a video for 1.1 minute long, you're lucky. I mean, it's just a much shorter time span and attention span because of all the bells, buzzers, and whistles that are put on every day.
Let me ask you one thing about Extreme Rising. I noticed on the first show that you had wrestlers like Matt Hardy and Sylvester Turquet from the WWF WWE version of ECW. How do you view those wrestlers and just the WWE ECW in terms of the canon of ECW?
Well, I mean, to me, the WWE version of ECW and the true ECW are like two sides of a coin. I mean, completely opposite things. So it's not to... I'm not from the school of thought, and I didn't watch much of the WWE's ECW, but when I did watch them, it didn't impress me and didn't intone to me what I thought we made ECW represent. So, but I'm not from the school of thought that anybody that ever worked for that WWE ECW is garbage and I'm never going to look at them. My point of view from the company standpoint is I want to give the fans as much different flavors of ice cream as I can give them. I remember Bill Watts used to say, at Thanksgiving, nobody wants just a big pile of turkey or all pumpkin pie. Everybody wants a little bit of everything and a lot of it. And, so that's what we're trying to do with Extreme Rising is give everybody all these different flavors at Thanksgiving dinner and let them decide what they want and they don't want. We'll pay close attention to what they like and what they don't like, and we'll try to give them as much of what they like as we can and take as much away of what they don't like. But the only way to figure out what they do want and what satisfies them is to give them a wide range of tastes. So for us at Extreme Rising, we just feel strongly to offer up to them, a whole bunch of new faces of talent that I've seen, throughout the years of traveling around the road. And I still see today, when I go out, one of the biggest things I do, one of the biggest thrills for me in going to independent shows is I get a chance to go out and watch a lot of the talent, either because they come up and ask me to, look at their match for them and give them pointers. But I also like to take a look and see if there's anybody there that I think has something. And usually, just about every show, you can see somebody that has something that you see in them. It might be charisma. It might be a look. It might be the way they move in the ring. That they have some basic building block that you can build on. And that really is how every great wrestler started. Just there's a smidgen of something there. And can we foster that? So that's what we're trying to do with Extreme Rising is give the fans all these different tastes and let them decide. If you go back and look at the original ECW in the early years especially, I'd be willing to bet you couldn't boil that down to one or two words in a definition. There was everything on there. You had Sabu doing all this crazy, maniacal, homicidal, crazy stuff. And then you had Taz doing mat wrestling and suplexes. And you had Shane Douglas doing these promos. And you had Tommy Dreamer doing all this, crazy, innovative type extreme stuff. And you had Raven doing the street thug. And you had Sandman doing the town drunk. And you had, it was literally all over the place. And all that. You had 911 coming out and choke slamming people. Then you had two white guys, pretending to be black guys, with Teddy and Johnny. So it really was a hodgepodge. It was a bunch of everything. And so pretty much anybody that would watch would get something satisfied in watching it.
If you don't mind, I'd like to go back to your first big break was when you got into the UWF. Now, did you get into the UWF right before Crockett bought it?
Shortly before, yeah, several months before. Eddie Gilbert and Terry Taylor had come up. Of course, Dominic DiNucci had trained me and Mick Foley and Cody Michaels and several other students. And he'd have shows up in the Ohio, Cleveland, Lorain, Ohio area, down into West Virginia and Western Pennsylvania. And he had hooked up, he and Bill Watts had known each other from the road years before. And at a time when Bill Watts was trying to go national, to take the UWF national to compete with Vince, he contacted Dominic to run shows, to see if he could get some of the UWF talent on shows that Dominic was running in those areas. And luckily enough for Mick and I, Terry Taylor and Betty Gilbert, Missing Link, Buddy Roberts, Chris Adams, Missing Link, Missy Hyatt, Dark Journey. They all came up and did a loop with us up through all those areas, and Dominic would always put me and Mick Foley on the opening match because we'd have a really good chemistry and worked well together. And they saw Terry Taylor was sort of assisting. Bill Watts was the booker, but he was busy trying to run the company. So Eddie, who was his assistant, sort of became by proxy the booker, and Terry Taylor was sort of assisting him. So it was pretty much Eddie Gilbert was the booker, Terry Taylor was assisting him. And they saw Mick and I having these matches on Dominic's shows, and towards the end of the tour came up and asked if either of us had ever thought of going on the road. You know, were we interested in going on the road? And I don't think either of us had at that point, not because we didn't want to. I just didn't believe that either of us thought we had the talent to. And so several weeks after that tour, Eddie Gilbert called me at home and asked if I wanted to go in, and said he wanted to bring me and Mick in. And I went in first, and right after I went in, Bill Watts installed a hiring freeze. Maybe a week or two after I went in, he froze all incoming hires because he was working on that deal with Crockett. So I luckily got my foot in the door and was able to, you know, sort of sneak in that before that door slammed shut, and Mick had to wait for several more years to try to get his break in the business, a big break in the business. And you know, it was time well spent because, I mean, the career he's had has been a pretty good career.
Okay. Let me ask you, because we're about to be cut off here because they only give us 45 minutes. My favorite match from ECW ever was your match with Too Cold Scorpio at A Matter of Respect. Like, I consider that a match that's almost perfect.
Well, Scorp was a great talent. He is a great talent, you know, and we had an awful lot to accomplish that night. There were so many different facets of what needed to be accomplished, you know, with the tournament and wrapping it up and the whole aftermath of that match. I think one of the things that, and again, we could Monday morning quarterback, but I think one of the things that Paul, and I'm sort of sketchy on all the, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg. But, you know, I think that Paul really missed the boat with Too Cold, that he could have really gotten a lot more out of Too Cold before he left. And I think Too Cold's career would have gotten a lot more out of it had he stayed. And I can't recall what happened first. Did he leave before that? It's been so long. But I think Too Cold was and is an extraordinary talent that has never been fully utilized.
You know, that's what I think, because I have a friend that we were talking about wrestling, and we both agreed with it, you know, and we can't figure it out because WWF couldn't even, you know, and this is a time period when they were really using guys, you know, when they got big with Austin, and it didn't seem like he could catch a break.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just one of those things where it's, you know, not in the right place at the right time. The company's not thinking in the direction of what your talents are. For whatever reason, I mean, there's so much that go into it. You know, it goes into creating a star. It's, you know, a lot of luck. It's, you know, the stars lining up right and the fans' wants and desires being in the right place. And, you know, just one of those things that, you know, like catching lightning in a bottle. I mean, there are so many factors that go into it. You know, you could start the same character 25 times in different companies, and it might catch on once someplace and get huge. I don't think Too Cold's lack of becoming the biggest star in the business is any detriment to his talent. I think it's just more one of those things, not in the right place at the right time, or one or more of those factors not lining up in the favor of what he had to offer. But, you know, clearly he had the talent and has the talent to have been that.
Okay, and let me see here, because I could probably talk to you for hours, just come up with your questions. What do you consider your best match ever? Like, if you had to put one match on your tombstone, that, you know, saying, okay, that's what I want to put in the time capsule.
Wow, I've never thought of that. I would say it's almost impossible to say, because there's so many things that, you know, so many ways. How do you define a great match? Was it every spot hit, or was it a, you know, a bloodbath? Was it, you know, a fast match, a slow match? There's so many things to go into. There's a lot of matches I was proud of. I mean, I was proud of the night we threw the belt down. In hindsight, because what it is, it literally put ECW on the map. And it's the one, it's the one point that defines my career. So as scary as it was to do that night, you know, I'm proud of, probably that's, if you said one singular moment that I'm most proud of, it would probably be that. I'm proud of my matches with Taz. I'm proud of my matches. I'm proud of the three-way dance, the first three-way dance with Sabu and Terry Funk. I wasn't so much that night as it happened, because it was such a different match than I'd been used to. I thought we really missed the bullseye. I thought we had a great opportunity. If you watch me as I'm laying on the mat on the apron afterwards with Sherry, I'm laying there disgusted to myself that I didn't do more to try to pick the pace of the matchup or something, because it just didn't feel like a right kind of match, because it was so different of a match. You know, we had never seen anything like that here in the States, and I'd certainly never participated in anything like that. So it just felt odd and queer to me. And afterwards, as I was laying there trying to catch my breath because the building was just unbelievably hot, Sherry started saying, "Oh my God, look, look, look!" And I look up and I see the crowd giving us a standing ovation, and I thought, "Oh, they're just being polite. You know, they're just being kind because we worked for 60 minutes." And then I went back and I watched it afterwards. And after watching it afterwards, I thought, boy, I caught what the fans were saying. It was just it was so different, but so cool to see it, because in that difference, it just had such a different vibe and feel, and yet it showcased all three characters extraordinarily well. So I'm proud of that. I'm proud of the fact that it's become a match that, you know, promoters today go to in the United States as a way to showcase three competing characters. I'll tell you a match that stands out in my head that I was really proud of as champion. I think it was probably one of my better performances as champion in ECW was the night that I wrestled with Chris Chetty in the opening match. We didn't have anybody.
Yeah, I remember that.
Everybody else was angled off. You know, all the top guys were angled off and different storylines. And Paul came to me and said, "Who do you want to work with tonight?" And I said, "Where do you got?" And he goes, "Well, pretty much nobody. Everybody's angled up and storylines, and you know, you can work with this person, this person." He gave me like a list of five or six names. And I looked around the dressing room and I said, "Give me Chris Chetty. Put us on an opening match." And he thought I was nuts at first. I said, "I'm telling you, do it." The fans, it was such a different concept. You never see the champion go out and wrestle first of all. You never, you know, in the old context of the business, here's a young kid against a world champion. But in that quixotic formula is where the ECW fans would overthink themselves. Why is Shane Douglas wrestling him in the opening match? This makes no sense. They must be dropping the belt. Because that's what the fans, they would try to outthink us as we would move along. And if you go back and watch that match, you'll see the fans exploding on the false finishes because they believe the belt's being changed. And, you know, it just was one of those ideas that, you know, might have missed by a country mile, but on that night it worked. And Chris was confident and comfortable with me, even though he was very nervous before the match. He followed my lead and played along and gave what I asked of him, and it worked. In that own special way, it worked. And then one of my favorite people to work with as champion was Pitbull 2. Anthony Durante was a special guy. I miss him in the business. He was a good guy, a guy you could really warm up to. He's had a really good soul about him. But I felt probably most at ease in the ring with him because I know he felt comfortable. I could sense that he was comfortable with me. And so as I was working with him, spots would just roll out of my head because I didn't have to like try to stay a step ahead of him. All I had to do was
Shane,
beating his character.
They're about to cut us off.
What's that?
Thank you. They're about to cut us off.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much for coming in, and if you can, I'd like to do this again some other time because you have a lot of insight.